Hello.
Hey, Kat, how are you, brother? Dave Lawrence, Hawaii Public Radio.
Hi, how you doing, man? What's going on?
Hey, you got a good connection, my brother. Sounds like you're in the next room or something like that. Can you hear me good, too?
Yeah, man, I hear you. You're really great, man. Where are you? Honolulu?
Yeah, where are you at?
San Jose.
Okay, well, we got a good one. We're lucky today. That's a blessing. And you're set? You're ready to go? You're good?
Yeah, man, ready to rock, man.
You're an animal. I love it.
Ready to rock.
Let me just put a short introduction on it, and we'll get started.
All right, cool.
It's All Things Considered, Hawaii Public Radio, and I'm Dave Lawrence. Today we are welcoming back a legendary reggae band to the show, Third World. It's a group that we've had on a few times over the years, too. We've been so fortunate, including the late Bunny Ruggs Clark, as well as the talented multi-instrumentalist we're welcoming today and back to the show, too. It's a guitar player, a cellist, founder of Third World, one of the longest-running reggae groups in the world, forming back in 1973, still going very strong today. A unique hybrid, too, of soul and R&B and funk have factored into their unique sound. And plus, how many reggae groups break out a cello in concert? It's a gigantic thrill to welcome back to All Things Considered from Third World their gifted guitar player, cellist, and leader, Stephen Cat Core. Aloha, Cat. Thank you for doing this, brother.
Yeah, man. Aloha, man. How's everything?
Everything is very good. Thank you for asking. You, how you doing?
Good. I'm over in California here enjoying the sunshine, sitting by the pool with the great bass player, Richard Daly, you know? Yeah, chilling out and looking forward to coming down your guys' way very soon. You know, we love Hawaii and we miss it a lot, but probably we don't get over there enough, but, you know, it doesn't mean there's any love left.
Now, I know that, and there is a lot of love, and that's a good thing you say, because considering you've actually released, I mean, how many bands have released live music that was recorded here in Hawaii, so it really must be a special tour stop. How long have you actually been coming, Kat?
I think our first trip there was probably around 1981, 82, just after the Cry to Love album.
Okay, that's a little...
We started to come there, and we had a sense of purpose. It was quite a popular song there, so, you know, we did do quite a bit down there around that time. That was the album that followed up on Try to Love. So, you know, we love it. We love it, and it's a joy to be talking to you, bro.
It's a wonderful thing, and it's so great that this is a group that actually has had such a long history here, and as we've already known, reggae and Hawaii, that's an unusual thing, huh? How when you must feel at home when you get here and you see the flag, the colors of Jamaica, and then Bob's picture everywhere, it's a little surreal, isn't it?
Yes, it is, but it's understandable because island life lends itself to our music, you know, and, you know, the Hawaiian population just really took on to the whole Bob Marley, the whole reggae thing, and you know, they've been into the music a long time. I mean, Toots, you know, he's very popular there. Steel Pulse, you know, it's not a new phenomenon with Hawaii. Hawaii has loved reggae music a long time, and it's a joy. It's going to be great to get back there, and it's going to be slightly different circumstances because we're going to play in the Blue Note, you know, like a smaller environment, but that's why it's so sweet, you know?
It's been great for other groups. We had Black Uhuru was in there, Ducky and the gang. It sounded really good. Whalers have been in there. It's a nice room. Maxi Priest, I think you're going to really like it.
That's fantastic.
I think
we've done the ones in Japan, and we really enjoyed, you know, doing them.
Yeah, you've got to get to some of the greatest venues, too, around the world, and we'll talk about some of those. Another thing about you, though, thinking about the background of how reggae is here in Hawaii, and I think about your personal background, when it comes to your parents, both of them really, really interesting folks. And when anyone sees you or listens to you speak or watches you break out a cello, let's say, in concert. So let's start with your mother and her role in exposing you to music and how the Jamaican Youth Orchestra factors into things.
My mom actually was like one of the premier piano teachers of the Caribbean, and that's how she would have encouraged me to play music. But it really started out for me personally, it started out when she was playing her records, you know, her Casals records on the gramophone in those days. And, you know, I would react to it. So she kind of started me out on the piano because that was where she was coming from. But, you know, I really gravitated more to the string instrument. So that's how that really started. But mom, she was a piano player.
It's obvious the influence that, she played. So she's playing piano and she was doing it professionally. Kind of describe as you remember when, because this has obviously played a huge role. And then talk about finding the cello. That's an unusual instrument to still have in your life.
Well, her situation, her story is an incredible one because she's what we call in the Caribbean an island scholar. And she won the one scholarship given to students from, like, Trinidad, Barbados, the Leeward Islands. In those days, there was only one scholarship given to students from all those islands. And from Jamaica, we had a scholarship called the Jamaica Scholarship, which is, like, equal to a Rhodes Scholarship, but you don't have to play sports. But to get a Rhodes Scholarship, you have to be a sportsman as well as an academic. So my dad won the Jamaica scholarship and she won the Island scholarship.
Incredible.
And that's how they met. They met at McGill University. She was pursuing communications and music and dad was studying economics.
And Mrs. McGill and then, University in Montreal.
Montreal, right. And then both of them wanted to go to England. Mom wanted to go and study with Lloyd Webber, who is Andrew Lloyd Webber's dad. And dad wanted to go to Oxford. And somehow it just worked for them, you know. And they both achieved it. My mom went and studied with Lloyd Webber. And dad went to Oxford. So their lives alone are pretty incredible. And I just give thanks for the fact that I was able to continue the legacy of playing music and keep it in the family, you know.
No, it's
I'm really thankful for that.
That's such a great attitude. And it really, that's just so humbling to listen to. I mean, the story is jaw-dropping, and the way that you interpret it and the gratitude you've got. And so backing up to when did you start to play the piano? How old were you when you first did that, and how old were you when you picked up the cello?
I think Mom would have probably started me on the piano at about five or six. And I know definitely at about 7 or 8, I had already been prepared for grade one. In those days, we did exams like, you know, grade one, grade two, grade three, right up to LRSN, which was the highest exam you could take before you're going into college to study music, you know. So I think I would have been taking grade one at about 7. So by 7, 8 years old, I was already playing the cello because I started turbulent when I was 17.
Say that again, Stephen. You were far away from the mic. Say that whole sentence again.
Sorry. I started turbulent when I was 17, and I had been in inner circle band since I was 13. So I'd have been into pop music from 13 years old. So all those years before, that was strictly classical music and cello, and I was in the Jamaican Youth Orchestra. I was the one who was in the Youth Orchestra.
Wow. So you were
a great experience for me too, you know,
playing the cello in the youth orchestra.
Yeah, it was a great experience for me because a lot of the kids who were in youth orchestra were older than me, so I really had to step up to the plate, you know. I mean, some of the stuff that they played was a challenge for me, but it helped to mold me. It helped to bring out something in me that was like, you know, that meticulous drive to be good. So, you know, it's all good. It's all good.
It's incredible. So you're 7, I think you said, when you started on the cello.
Yeah.
And when you, the Forster Davis School of Music, I read, and hopefully I'm right, it entered your life. How does that factor into, because you talk about this education, incredible background with your parents and their drive and the schools that they went to, the high bar, basically, they set for themselves, which they achieved. And then thinking about this drive with the music, how does that school play a role in your life today when you look back?
It plays the biggest role in my life, bro. Because Noel Foster Davis, who was the founder of the Foster Davis School, totally responsible for molding me musically. Because, see, my mom realized that being so close to her, teaching me wasn't going to really work out. You know, there was too much family and emotion involved there. So she sent me out to the best person who she thought would be good to mold me as a musician. And she was right, because with Foster Davis, I have nothing but pure love and respect for her. You know, she died some years back because she was getting on in age and she had been, you know, she had been sick with diabetes and all of that. But, you know, she's totally responsible for molding my cello career and my guitar career in a way. Because when I decided I fell in love with pop music, you know, she kind of encouraged me. And she said, you know, anything that you're going to do musically, make sure you do it good. So if you're in love with pop music now, I'll tell your mom that, you know, you can start out some guitar lessons with me. And then we take it from there. And that's basically what I did. And I'm very happy for Miss Foster Davis, because she really, she was at the center of my musical life. And my mom just kind of, my mom just kind of sat back and let it all happen, which I'm really so thrilled and happy for. And I love my mom so much, because I didn't find out all the glorious stuff about my mom until I got bigger. And my two brothers started to tell me, look, mommy's no joker. She's an island scholar. And then I started to read about her. And I really understand, you know, because when you're in a family and your mom, you know, she's baking cakes and she's cooking chicken and sundaes, rice and peas, and you know, you have that kind of relationship. And then, but to find out the accolades and to find out, you know, that she would have sat on Lloyd Webber's doorstep and waited until he came home to get to study with him, and was taking care of Andrew Lloyd Webber when he was a baby and all of that.
Wow.
It's something very special for me, you know, so I really treasure all of that stuff. But just to answer your question, I could speak about this. I could write a book about this, you know, but just to speak quite candidly and quickly about it, Miss Foster Davis is at the center of my musical life, I have to tell you.
That's a wonderful thing to say, and it's a great, that's why when I was introducing you and talking about your parents, they're, it's a fascinating story, and you can see the impact it had on you as you're talking, and the way that it has completely shaped your life, and the discipline that you obviously learned there, and the discipline that came from both your folks. And we haven't really covered him yet, and it wouldn't be appropriate, because it's really a not a lot of people may know, and not a lot of people have a father who would be a heavy political figure. He helped, according to what I read, and forgive me if I have it wrong, he helped draft the Jamaican Constitution, I read. He played a number of different heavy roles in the history of the country, and had ministerial positions that were massive. Fill in his history a little bit, and the ways that shaped you.
Well, I think that the most important thing I can say about him is that this encouragement I got from him, you know, being that his side of the thing was more in a political and his law career, you know, he sort of backed off of the music thing, but there was always encouragement there, because he knew that I was in good hands with my mom, you know. So I never really, Dad never really played any big role in terms of trying to encourage me to do this, encourage me to do that musically. You know, it was just there through my mom and through my friends who I grew up with, you know. But Dad's life was one of extraordinary life. I mean, he was one of the greatest attorneys Jamaica has ever produced. He served 4 different ministries. He served Attorney General, Minister of Finance, Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Minister of Legal Affairs. So, you know, as I say, it's just a blessing, and that's the way I look at it. You know, I don't look at it as, you know, like saying it's a big deal. Other people say, wow, that's incredible and all of that. But to me, as I say, it doesn't seem that way when you're growing up in a house and everybody's just there. And, you know, as I say, Sunday, it's rice and peas, chicken,
right,
you know, some lemonade. You're kicking football with your brothers out in the backyard and stuff. And you don't think that one day you're going to be doing an interview on Hawaii and Reader talking about this stuff, but it's just something great that happened for me, and I thank God every single day. I thank him for making that happen, you know, and yeah, that's it. Not much more I can say.
He did help draft the Jamaican Constitution, that is true?
That's true, yes.
That's just that's so heavy, because also the thing about it, Kat, is, as you know, reggae and politics not far away from each other. When you look back at the relationship, and I mean, I think about some of the stuff that many reggae fans, even in the United States, would know about. The events that have happened there, the political things. Like, for example, that Smile Jamaica concert. You played at that?
Smile Jamaica, yeah. Third World performed at that concert.
Was your father there?
Yes, I believe he was here, but not in a prominent way. Michael Manley was the prominent personality there, but Dad was there somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, I know for sure he was there somewhere, but it's not as if he was on the front line. You know, he was more like, you know, he was more like, kind of like, I wouldn't say the background, but he was probably with his other cronies, and they were very, you know, they were very much close to Michael. So, but yeah, that's another special moment for all of us too, you know.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. Now, you get what I mean about the, so while he had a different impact on you, and obviously I can see that the impact your mom had and the music teacher, but you can see there's a very close bridge. I mean, when you say that's a special moment, what are memories of that? I mean, even you must have even been excited when you heard you were booked to be part of that, what would end up being one of the most historic concerts ever in Jamaica.
Yeah, well, I mean, the history developed because of the tragedy of getting shot and all of that stuff happening. So, you know, that's how it developed into that whole thing. But the concert was really meant to be like a, almost like a peace concert, trying to bring the political factions together, you know. But something went wrong, and there have been so many, you know, stories about it, so many conspiracy theories, almost like the Kennedy thing, you know?
Right.
But there are all these stories all these people have written about, which I'm sure, I know you're clearly a research person, so I know you've seen what I'm talking about. And having not really known firsthand all the details, I've always tried to shy away from it, but what I do know is that I remember the shooting very, very vividly, because I had actually been someone who visited Bob's house very regularly and used to hang out with the Wailers and with Bob. And, you know, just so happened that this night I had not been there. And it's just nice to know that the powers that be kept me away from that whole thing.
You were there that night, you're saying?
No, I'm saying that it's just nice that the powers that be kept me away that night.
Right. Oh, I get it. Right. Because you were regularly visiting him, you're saying, and you were lucky you weren't there.
Regular. You know, and after that, the whole concept was in jeopardy because Bob didn't really want to. I don't want to say he was afraid, but he figured that whole political thing had gotten too much. It was, if that was going to happen, it was something that needed to be avoided and that he wouldn't do. But eventually he decided that this was the way to go, and he came down to the park, and half of his band wasn't there. So, yeah, we filled the spaces. I played bass for a couple of songs. Then Tyrone came, and Tyrone took the bass from me, and then eventually, you know, Donald Kinsey came, and it was incredible.
Oh my, I mean, just, I get chills just the way you're describing it. I mean, you describe it really well, and that's to think that there you are, so young, on the stage with him, and you mentioned, you know, you were spending a lot of time with him. Backing up a little bit, was that prior to being signed by Island Records? Can you kind of explain how you developed a relationship with him? Because I understand after that happened, you guys ended up touring together, opening for the Wailers.
Yeah, well, it's like that would have been just after we would have signed with Island. It would be the year after we signed with Island when we did that concert. You know, It's like, for my personal thing, I would have known Bob Marley from when I was a member of Inner Circle, because we would have played and backed Bob Marley up. That was when Bob Marley was just himself, Peter and Bonnie. And he would have been on shows performing where Inner Circle was the band that backed all the artists. We backed Toots, we backed Delroy Wilson, we backed Ken Booth, we backed Bob Marley and the Wailers, we backed all of those bands, all of those singers. We Inner Circle were responsible as a backing band for them. That's before they all got their own bands and things changed, you know. And so that was my experience with Bob from early. That's how I met him. That's how I knew about his immense talent and his impact and just being in the room with you or being near you. He had a presence and a personality that was, you know, just something very special. So I was a big fan from then. So when this whole thing happened and he put out Catch a Fire album and stuff, when I heard Concrete Jungle, my whole life changed in terms of, like, I said, yeah, this is what I want to do.
Wow.
I want to have a group where all of us are, you know, writing our own music and playing and stuff. And, you know, I never saw myself as a iconic public figure like Bob, but I saw myself as a band leader and someone who would bring people together to play music. And that's how the whole Third World thing developed, you know. So there was never a one personality in Third World that really was, like you would say, the icon on the billboard. It was all of us, you know, which I still treasure to this day. And that's why you find that when people like Bonnie Ruggs pass away, and most recently this week we lost Carrot, who was a big part of our beginnings and stuff. And so when things like that happen and the outpouring of love comes out, it means that you achieve what you want to achieve, because everybody in the band has their place in history, has their place on the billboard, on the marquee, you know. So that for me is very special, that Third World was able to do that, you know, create personalities who made a band instead of not just one, you know, one solo face. You know, we had six faces, you know.
That's a pretty heavy statement, too. I mean, when you think about the way that he, you call him like a lead. You referred to Bob as like a leader and that spiritual thing. And there's one cat, and everybody's, and he's sort of like the superstar entity. But way you guys have each brought something. I mean, on that note, former Third World member Irwin Carrot Jarrett, who passed on just recently. How did you, I mean, that's a cat, he was from the very earliest days, true? And then you say such nice things about him, and it's so nice that you could have parted ways professionally, but yet still maintain such a respectful, dignified way of speaking about him.
Yeah, because we didn't necessarily part ways in a indignation or arrogant or, you know, or
negative. It was a positive parting, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at the time, it may have seemed a little bit hot and, you know, tempers flared and everything, and he left. But there was never any animosity through the years between us. We've always been close. That's one thing about the Third World family. Even the members who have left, we've always kept good relationship with everybody, you know. We really have. And they needed to move on in their direction, but the band needed to stay together and to be who we are today. And that was something that particularly me and Richie fought for, you know, as the two members of the band right now who are still the long-standing founders. And we always stuck up for that, you know. The band was always more important than us. And based on that, I think that that's why I believe that faith and Mother Nature and the good old Father and above has kept us going and has been so kind to us. I mean, look, I'm coming to Hawaii in 2018. Can you imagine that?
It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Great way to look at it with the gratitude you're saying there. And when you talk about, you said something there about the good Lord or something looking after you. When I think about flashing to where you guys are at today, Damian Marley, one of Bob's children, has produced some recent singles for you. They include Eyes Are Upon You. Must be a trip to have him in that role. And talk a little bit about the message in that song.
Yeah, man, it's fantastic to have him in that role. And not only that, but, you know, he would have grown up in my house. So, you know, it makes life even more special that he's producing his uncle now, you know. And it's fabulous. And Eyes Are Up On You is a great song. I mean, it you know, bro, I can't talk much about it. Wait until you hear the rest of the material that this guy is producing for us. You're not going to believe it.
I'm sure.
You're not going to believe it, sir. Trust me.
I'm sure.
When I get to Honolulu, I'm there. I'm going to play a couple of them for you and give you a preview if I get to meet you, you know.
I would love to do a follow-up interview if you have some time when you're in town.
Yeah, of course.
We'll come by the venue if that's cool. I'll work it out with your people. Well, final question, and then I'll let you go, my brother, because I'm sure it's an interesting story, or maybe it's not. How did you pick up the nickname Cat?
About a year before I entered the Inner Circle, I started a band on my road, on my avenue called the Alley Cats. And so I just got the name. I got the name Fat Cat because I was fat at that time. Yeah, and then I lost the fat and just became Cat. So that's basically it. But I have to go to sound check. So when I see you in Hawaii, I'll give you some more stories. Quite funny, really.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It's Stephen Catcore, Third World at the Blue Note, and our guest here on All Things Considered. Thank you, my brother. I can't wait to see you. Travel safe.
All right. See you soon, bro.